Must the sun set on the west? An Indian explores the soul of Western civilization. From Michelangelo to Freud, the devolution of human dignity. Welcome to Dr. Vishal Mangalwadi's lecture, From Michelangelo to Freud, the devolution of human dignity. This lecture was delivered at the University of Minnesota as a part of a series entitled, Must the Sun Set on the West? An Indian Explores the Soul of Western Civilization. The series was sponsored by the McLaurin Institute and Heart of the Matter Lecture Series, and filmed by the Mahoney Media Group. Dr. Mangalwadi was born and raised in India. He has authored or co-authored 13 books and lectured in 30 countries. In this lecture, he suggests that the doctrine of human dignity was a foundational assumption that made the West unique. Renaissance artist Michelangelo depicted the theological source of this idea on the dome of the Sistine Chapel in Rome, in his iconic painting of God creating Adam in his own image. Dr. Mangalwadi laments that following Charles Darwin, William James, and Sigmund Freud, the West has demolished a source of its beauty. The devolution of man from a spiritual being to a mere animal is resulting in the West's decline. However, the sun need not set on the West, because Freud's interpretation of who we are is demonstrably false.
In this 10-part lecture series, I will be exploring with you the soul of Western civilization. Tonight, we are looking at the notion of human dignity, which I consider to be the greatest discovery of Western civilization. The idea was best captured by Michelangelo in his painting in Sistine Chapel of God creating Adam in his image. That notion of unique dignity of human being was lost when the West began to follow Darwin's and Freud's idea that a human being is nothing more than an animal. This devolution of human dignity indicates the fact that the sun might now be setting on the West. But I want to begin with you exploring the concept of human dignity. And I'd like to tell a story. My wife is from North India, as I am, but she came to America in 1971 as a student and studied here for 4 years. She returned to India in 74, and we were married in 1975 because both of us felt called to serve the poor. Soon after we were married, we left the city and started living in what was essentially a room with three walls and a curtain, shared with snakes and scorpions and mongoose and all, and my brother and his wife in the next room like that, and my uncle, etc. And we began serving the poor. Now, I was at that time writing my first major book, The World of Gurus, and Ruth was editing it and typing it on a typewriter. We had two wooden planks coming out on the side of our bed from the wall, and I sat on one on a stool and wrote, and she sat on the other side and typed. But when she was faster than me, when there is not enough work, she would take a bicycle, go into the village about 1.5 miles away, and she started going door to door, every home, to try and understand where the village was, particularly where the children were, how many were going to school, what were they learning, what could we do to bless them, support them, and to make a difference to the life in our village. So as she was surveying every single home, trying to make an entire list of how many children there are and what's the status of the life in the village, she ran into a 10-year-old girl, Lalta, and she asked, Ruth asked Lalta, how many brothers and sisters do you have? Lalta said, 3, maybe 4. So Ruth said, do you have 3 or do you have 4? She said, well, 3, the fourth is almost dead. So Ruth said, can I come and see this child who is almost dead? So she had to bend down and go through a little door into this mud hut without a window, and without any lighting inside. In the middle of the room was a bare string cot and an 18-month-old skeleton lying on that cot with pus oozing from her entire body, including from her head, from sores and flies all over her because she couldn't even raise her hands to chase flies. She had become so weak that she couldn't cry. When she tried to cry, she only sighed. Her thighs were as thick as an adult's thumb, and she was 18 months old. So as Ruth looked at this pathetic skeleton, she started to cry and asked the mother, "What's wrong with this child?" The mother smirked and said, "Oh, she doesn't eat anything. Whatever we give her, she vomits." So Ruth said, "Are you taking her to the doctor?" "Oh, what's the use? What can the doctors do if she doesn't eat anything?" So Ruth said, "You know, how do you know what the doctors can or cannot do? But isn't this a pathetic situation that needs immediate attention?" The mother got a little irritated. She said, "You know, how can we afford to go to the doctor?" And Ruth didn't understand that they were so poor that they couldn't go to a free clinic in city. So Ruth said, "Really? You know, I will give you the money to take this child to the hospital." The mother said that, I'm afraid of the hospital and the city. I can't go there." So Ruth said, "Well, take your husband. But he doesn't have the time. He has to look after the fields and the cattle. How can he go?" So Ruth said, "Really? Okay, I will pay you so that he can hire a laborer for a day to look after his fields and for him to come with you, and I'll come with you to help you navigate your way around." The mother tried to end the conversation, said, "Okay, I'll speak to my husband." So Ruth cycled back and got after me that, "Now you have to go and talk to the husband." So I went in the evening. The couple weren't expecting me, and they had made up their minds that they were not going to the hospital. "Why? We don't have the money." "But my wife told you that we're going to give you the money." "No, but we don't want to get into debt." "Oh, I'll give you in writing that this is a gift, not a loan. We're never going to ask you for this money back." "But where is the time?" "Well, my wife told you that we'll pay for a laborer so that you can create time and come." That really got them irritated. "Why are you bothered? She's our daughter." Now, I didn't understand how to interpret that. Why am I bothered? Why am I trying to help? The only way I could interpret that question was that they really wanted her to die. So I didn't believe that any parent could do that, but there was no other way to understand that attitude. So I decided to raise my voice, at least pretend to be angry, and said, "Are you killing this child? If you're killing this child, why are you being so cruel? Why don't you take up a knife and stab her instead of letting her go through this agony and pain and suffering?" They were stunned. I said that, "Look, if you don't take this child to the hospital tomorrow, I'm going to bring the police here and lodge a complaint that you are killing this child." So by this time, obviously, there was a crowd around me. Their neighbors had come, and I was trying to intentionally put the pressure of public opinion on them. And I looked around for moral support. Everybody looked at me as though I was a fool. And I didn't realize until a few months later that I was, in fact, foolish. I didn't realize they were doing what everybody did in the village. "You already have one girl. Why do you need the second girl? The first one can cook and clean and look after the siblings. Why are you taking this trouble to bring her up?" Anyway, one elderly gentleman, neighbor, told them that, "Look, this fellow is crazy. He might actually bring the police. And then if the police took the daughter to the hospital, you will have to pay the bill. So since he's offering to pay, why don't you go?" So they came along. We took them to a hospital where she was so weak that she couldn't even be fed through her nose fluid. She had to be put in intravenous. In a week or so, she regained enough strength so that they could start feeding her with a tube. And then after another week or so, the doctor said that, you know, the bill is getting too high. So why don't you take her to your home and feed her? And the doctor said, I will come to your home once a week or so and look at her. And let's see where she goes. So she came and stayed in our home for a month. There was obviously no disposable nappies and no washing machine. All the nappies had to be washed with hands, etc., etc. But all of us fell in love with that girl, and she began to respond to that love. For the first time, you could now see her smiling, etc. It was a very satisfying, gratifying experience. But about a month or so later, the mother came and started fighting that everyone in the village is saying that our daughter is eating food, Christians, she will become a Christian, and then we will be in trouble with our caste, we will be excommunicated, therefore we want our daughter back. So Ruth said, of course, we have no intention of taking your daughter, we want you to take her and look after her, please do, and we will pay for the milk. But we will give it directly to the milkman to make sure that the milk comes and that you feed this baby, and we will come and visit her. So Ruth started giving the milk to the milkman. The milk was supplied. But within a few weeks, the child was back to square one because the milk was being given to the boys. So the whole process had to be repeated. Ruth had to fight with the mother, then I had to fight with the father, then we had to take them to the hospital and then put her on intravenous and then bring her home, keep in our home, and then mother came back and fought again. We assume that by now she has learned her lesson, so we gave her another lecture on parental responsibility and gave the baby back to them, hoping that this time things will be better, but within a few weeks the child was dead. Now, I was convinced that the parents had killed the children. Ruth thought that this was impossible. No parents could possibly do that. So, until we had three more experiences of that nature, when Ruth finally realized that infanticide is a very common practice in our area, and therefore we should never take this risk. If a parent doesn't want a child, we should keep the child and find another home for that child. So we made that a practice that no questions, no arguments. If you don't want the child, we will find a home for this child. Now, I won't go into those stories, but to raise the question that here was a clash of two worldviews. We saw this child very differently than they saw this child as a liability, that you feed her for 10, 12 years, treat her, educate her, then you have to find money, get into debt to pay a dowry to get her married, and then the in-laws torture her to extract more dowry from them. As her whole life is suffering. Why don't we end this suffering quickly and smoothly, save hassle to ourselves and to them? And if someone argued with them, they would say that, look, if we had facilities for ultrasound, if we knew that this was going to be a second daughter, we would have aborted the baby. But since we didn't have that facility, we can only make a decision after she is born, when we know that this is a girl and we don't want her. So we are not doing anything different than what you do. And it doesn't take any effort. You don't need a knife to kill a child. All that you need is to, if it's too hot, keep him in the sun for a few hours. If it is too cold, don't cover him for one night, or don't feed him for 2-3 days. In some states in India, they might give a poisonous juice from poisonous berries as well. This is common. What I really want to suggest is that the problem was much deeper than the fact that the parents didn't see the value and the dignity and the rights of this baby. That this baby was precious and valuable and had a fundamental right to life. This wasn't part of their perspective or their culture's perspective. The problem was bigger, deeper, in the sense that the parents did not know their own human dignity. They didn't know that poverty, misery was not inevitable and inescapable. Life is suffering, as the Buddha has said, that is true. But life need not be suffering. Okay, her mother, her grandmother, her great-grandmother may have all experienced life as miserable and suffering. But future can be different. Future can be better. This daughter could in fact become a blessing to the whole family, lift the whole family out of poverty, transform the village. Think of Helen Keller. When she was 19 months old, she became deaf and blind. As a result, because she was so small, she also became dumb. Then she was shut up in her own self, unable to communicate with anyone in the world, frustrated, angry, irrational. Now, her life had no value. Here is a girl, deaf, dumb, and blind. Today in Holland, as the sun is setting, she would be euthanized legally. Holland is the first Western country which has accepted infanticide as legally permissible under certain circumstances. And that will happen in America as well, if this logic and the trend continues. But this was 100 years ago, where deaf, dumb, blind girl was not seen as a liability. She was still seen as the image bearer of God, valuable, with a fundamental right to life. So her nurse, teacher, maid, Anne Sullivan, continued loving her, serving her. One day, as you remember the story, Anne took her to a well, because there was a fragrance of honey, some flower, honeysuckle or whatever. And someone was drawing water, so the nurse put her hand under water, and as Helen was shocked by that experience, on the other hand, Anne started spelling water, first slowly and then suddenly. And Helen was mesmerized. All of a sudden, she understood that what was being drawn on her hand, W-A-T-E-R, was the name of this cool something that was falling on her hand. Her world changed. The magic of language began to make sense. She was excited. She came back home. And then that day, she says, she started learning language. She still was dumb, but with this writing now, father, mother, teacher, brother, sister, a number of words she learned one day in a few weeks or so, she began to speak, communicate, and then learn to type on a special Braille typewriter, and then became a mighty spokeswoman for handicapped children all over the world. Now, here was a very different worldview where a deaf, dumb, blind young girl is not useless, worthless child without value, significance, but is special, deserves special attention. Because back then the Western culture saw a human being as Michelangelo captured in this painting on Sistine Chapel, which is an iconic painting, Creation of Adam. And very often you don't notice that on the in the left hand, other hand of God, is Eve looking at Adam being created. Eve is already in the mind of God as a gift for Adam. Both are created by God. Now, Michelangelo was about 20 years old when Pico della Mirandola wrote this book, An Oration on the Dignity of Man, Pope Innocent III, who was one of the most brilliant medieval popes, had written a book on the misery of man. Yes, life is miserable, but it is a consequence of sin. That was not God's original intention. Life need not be miserable because man, in fact, bears the image of God. When I was an undergraduate student in the university, our professor taught us in India that the discovery of human dignity was indeed the greatest discovery of Western civilization. But they said that the Renaissance writers, beginning with Petrarch, the Italian poet, discovered the notion of human dignity when they started reading Greek or Roman classics. They actually didn't read Greek in those days. They read Latin, and they read some of the Greek works in Latin. Greek came later in Europe. But that's what we were taught, that the Christian Renaissance, not the 18th century secular humanism, but the Christian humanism of the 14th, 15th century came from Greek or Roman classics. And only after I came out of the university, I discovered that that was not the case. Yes, the discovery of who a human being is did become the force that enabled the West to create a civilization where citizens don't exist for the state. Individuals don't exist for their caste or their tribe, but the state exists for the individual. The king, the president, the prime minister, the government cannot trample upon an individual and his rights. To create a civilization where the president of America has all the power to do right, but no power to do wrong. If he does, he will be impeached. This was a mighty achievement, that the state exists for the individual, to defend the individual, to support the individual, to serve the individual. Individuals don't exist for the state, because individual is the image bearer of God. The whole notion of human rights, the whole notion of compassion, care, and education. The community needs to invest in every child. Those who need special attention, if they're blind or they're slow learners or whatever, they need special attention, special investment. They are valuable and precious. But those ideas did not come from Greek or Roman classics. In fact, they were a rebellion against the Greek cosmological worldview, which dominated even the Middle Ages. Michelangelo was simply capturing beginning with Petrarch, the humanist writers in the 13th, 14th, 15th century had been struggling and discovering, freeing the West from the impact of a Greco-Roman world. The Europe was essentially pagan. Paganism, animism, worship of angels and fear of spirits, and fatalism, which had come with Islam, and astrology, that had come in Europe. All of those, the notion of fate, notion of destiny, had stifled people in the Greco-Roman cosmological worldview. There was a supreme god, Zeus or Jupiter. He was great. Other gods were also great. Men were great. But they all had their fixed places in cosmos. Cosmos began with the Golden Age, degenerated into silver, bronze, iron, was destroyed and reborn. It went on in a cycle. Even the supreme god couldn't change the flow of history. Man had his place fixed in cosmos. Man couldn't change history. When man tried to behave like gods, he committed the sin of hubris. That was the Greek idea. So you had to appease gods, and you have to know your place and remain in your place. But this idea that no, man can in fact change his history, change culture, change his destiny. This idea came from first the nominalist, even before the Renaissance, the people like William of Ockham in Oxford and Jean Buridan in Paris University and others, when they began to understand the biblical idea of the freedom of God, they were called nominalists. This is nominal, the Christian nominalism, not the secular nominalism of the existentialists, etc. These people understood that God was free. He created the universe. He existed before the universe existed. So there was no the world of ideas of Plato, no world of logic which bound God. But God created everything because He existed before anything else existed. He is free. And therefore He can change. He chose the kind of universe He wanted to create and He can change. Miracles were possible. God was the first cause and could be the first cause in today's history, in culture, in nature. And now the nominalists didn't apply that notion of the freedom of God to man, but the Renaissance writers, beginning with Petrarch, but especially Salutati, he began to come to terms with the whole idea of the free will of man, that if man is made in God's image, then man is also to a certain degree free. He is not bound by fate or destiny or nature or culture or history. We can change things. That was the notion of human dignity, that man can transcend nature, man can transcend history. Now, you see that worldview in a movie like Lawrence of Arabia, a classic film. Lawrence is doing something which nobody believed could be done, mobilizing tribes, Middle Eastern tribes, to take over a city, and he is bringing them through a desert which no one thought you could cross, and then launch a successful attack on a city. Two young fellows try to take his life, but he has mercy on them and he co-opts them into his force. As they're nearing the city, the whole group is exhausted. They found that one of those two men who had tried to take his life, one of them is missing. He's fallen off his horse or camel, whatever it was, out of exhaustion and weariness. So Lawrence wants to go back and find him, rescue him, and all the tribal chiefs think this is crazy. You know, this fellow tried to kill you. You want to now go kill yourself trying to find him. So they state their worldview that, you know, it was written that he should die. Lawrence says nothing is written. Wow. He goes back, finds him, brings him back. Nothing is written. Now, that's the idea of human dignity. God is free. You're made in His image. You are free. You can be the first cause. You can create your destiny. This was the biblical view of man. Petrarch and Salutati and Lorenzo Valla, these people began writing about it. And finally, Pico della Mirandola, in this book, An Oration on the Dignity of Man, he summarized it. And his view of who man is came directly from Genesis 1, 26 to 27, that God said, let's make man in our image. So in His image He made them and said, you go and establish your dominion over this earth, rule over it, subdue that, rule over it, you manage this. This idea of that God as the creator, man is made in His image, was part of Islam, in as much as Islam also grew out of the Old Testament mindset. But in those traditions, it didn't create the notion of the dignity of man, because what Christianity added was the idea of incarnation. These people, the Renaissance writers in 13th, 14th, 15th century, they are writing, they are doing their thinking and theology in the face of Muslim challenge. Islam is an intellectual challenge in Europe. It is a military challenge. It has taken over part of Spain, part of France, etc. It is a threat to whole of Europe. And it's not just a military threat, it is also an intellectual threat. Islam is saying that the idea of incarnation is illogical, it is ridiculous, it is insulting to God, it isn't befitting the majesty of God. God is so great. How can you believe that he would come as a helpless babe in that manger in Bethlehem? This is ridiculous. How can you believe that this almighty God would die as a helpless sinner on the cross, helpless victim? This weak, humiliated, insulted Messiah. How can he be the almighty God? Can God become a dog? This is their intellectual challenge. This is where the biblical critique of Aristotle, his epistemology, by these Renaissance writers, changed Europe. What is supreme? Logic or observation? Facts. If God is free, then the universe is not bound by our logic. It is bound by his free will, what he chooses to do. How do we know truth? Do we deduce truth through logic that God cannot become man because man is so miserable and puny? Or do we find truth through observation? The question is not whether or not God can become man, but whether or not God did become man. What if God did become man? What are the implications of that? Well, maybe that man is different than a dog. Man is different than other animals. Maybe man is made in God's image. Maybe a human being is precious to God. So precious that God would come to this earth and give his life for man's salvation. So the idea of incarnation sealed the notion of human dignity, that God could become man because man was made in God's image to be God's child, to be God's representative. We cannot know man if we only look at animals. If man is made in God's image, the only way to know who man is, what man is for us to look at God. Now that's what Michelangelo is capturing in this painting in the Sistine Chapel. And as I said, so much of Western civilization has flowed out of this concept that we do not need, we cannot take the time right now to even begin to talk about it. We will talk some of it, some things about it when we discuss political freedom, economic development, etc., etc. But let's move on to the devolution of human dignity. You know, it begins with Charles Darwin's book, The Origin of Species, where Darwin looks at the data which Christians had been collecting. And when we talked about science, I mentioned that Darwin was not born in China, was not born in India, was born in England, because someone, a Indian sage, may have been far more intelligent than Darwin, but he couldn't have come up with Darwinian theory because the data didn't exist in India. But driven by biblical worldview and early chapters of Genesis, European church was, all Christian community was already looking at all the plants, all the animals, classifying them. So he had the data in front of him, and he began to propose this theory that maybe complex animals, including human beings, evolved from simpler animals. Now that was published in 1859. In 1872, Darwin wrote a second book called The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals. If human beings have evolved from animals, then human emotions have also evolved from animals. 12 years later, in 1884, William James, the American philosopher, took that notion from Darwin and wrote a very influential essay called What is an Emotion? And in that essay, he argued that emotion is the sum total of bodily changes, you know, your genes, your instincts, your hormones, your chemistry, your environment, etc. All the bodily changes that happen, that is what an emotion is. In other words, he came up with a totally materialistic explanation of emotion. Now that is what Freud picked up, and then Freud developed the Darwinian James's idea of what an emotion is, what love is, to its chemistry, that love is chemistry, sex, so love then really equals sex. And that became the intellectual background of the sexual revolution that we might talk about next Tuesday when we discuss the gender wars. I'm thinking of calling that lecture from Luther's Vicarage to Hefner's Harem. But haven't quite decided. We'll discuss it at that point. But essentially, what Freud is doing is not simply philosophy and psychology. He's changing culture. Until the beginning of the 20th century, the intellectual discourse in the West, particularly in the English-speaking world, was shaped by Jonathan Edwards' book, The Religious Affections. Jonathan Edwards was America's first philosopher who triggered the first Great Awakening. And his view of man, which was essentially Augustinian view of man, which was restated by him, his book is a study of 1 Peter, where Peter is writing to the Christians who are being persecuted. And he is saying, remember those days when you rejoiced in persecution. This is very unusual. If you're being persecuted, you should be fighting back. You should be cursing, abusing, mobilizing all your resources to save yourself. These people were rejoicing. They were full of joy and glory. So he had a dualistic idea, which, to go back into New Testament terminology, Paul talked about works of the flesh and fruit of the spirit. Anger, hatred, resentment, jealousy, passion, these are works of the flesh. Joy, love, forgiveness, happiness, peace, long-suffering, these are fruit of the spirit. In Jonathan Edwards' terminology, he talks about the religious affection and the passions of the flesh. So there was that dualism that man could choose. So this is the dualism. On the one hand are the works of the flesh, which are spontaneous emotions. On the other hand is fruit of the spirit. One can choose to ask for grace and walk in the spirit. Edwards is exploring what is revival. And this quest triggers off the Great Awakening. He's exploring what exactly is a revival. How does a man become a spiritual man? And that book becomes a philosophical, a worldview statement which undergirds America's Great Awakening. John Wesley abridged that book and published it in England, and therefore it began to shape the worldview of 18th, 19th, and early 20th century English-speaking world. But that is the intellectual world or paradigm which Freud finally destroys. So the passions of the flesh, or works of the flesh, and fruit of the spirit become a single category of emotion. Now you have a problem that you first of all have an explanation that, you know, someone threatens you, you get really angry, you hit back verbally or emotionally or physically or economically or whatever way. Where does this aggressiveness come from? Well, a few million years ago, your ancestors were reptiles. So when they felt threatened, they raised their hood and they counterattacked. That's part of your genes, your DNA, right? So If you are a therapist and a wife comes to you, she's angry at her husband and wants to kill him. What do you advise her? It is a legitimate emotion which is part of her DNA, her genetic makeup, her survival instinct. If everything is an emotion, it is biological, chemical, hereditary. You can't have moral judgment on one being right, one being wrong, that she should actually forgive. She should, in fact, look at her faults and repent. She should persevere. She should endure and turn the other cheek, etc., etc. How does a therapist get all of that perspective? Obviously, he can't. So, what do you do? Well, Freud's problem is, since he has rejected the notion of God, God doesn't exist, then man can only be an animal, a monkey. And biology and chemistry have to explain everything. Now, in their quest to investigate if human being was only an animal reacting to physical stimuli, Freud and his followers did observe some things that are true about us. There is an aspect to us which is like animals. Obviously, there is an aspect of us which is animal. We share a lot in common with animals. There are a lot of animals at different stages. Some animals have more memory, some have less. Some have more emotions, some have less. The emotion is a category that could legitimately be used for animals and for human beings. And that is what, in Jonathan Edwards' language and the language of the New Testament, one would call the works of the flesh. A lot of our reactions are spontaneous and physical and chemical. We don't necessarily have control over them without the help of medication or social restraints, etc. The question is, does man have something which animals don't have, and that is free will? Is there an element in man which transcends biology and chemistry? So I'm hungry, but can I fast unto death to choose that I'm not going to eat? Food is there. Nobody is telling me not to eat. I have no external restraint. But I can make a choice that I'm in a situation like Joseph in the Bible is in a situation where his boss's wife is seducing him. And he's a young man. He's not married. He likes the woman. But can he say that, no, I'm not going to sin against God? So, does man have a free will which makes him morally responsible creature in a way that animal is not? A goat is hungry and sees your banana or sees your spinach, eats it, and you don't say that the goat has stolen. A boy is hungry and takes your banana, you say that you have stolen, you shouldn't be stealing. It doesn't matter if you are hungry. Theft is morally wrong. Now, once you reject Michelangelo's picture of man being endowed with God's freedom, there's something in us which makes us free will, that we are moral creatures in a way that animals are not. If a monkey takes your mango, you're not going to hold him responsible for theft. Einstein had a problem there. He was the leading scientific mind of the 20th century. But his worldview was essentially materialistic. That ruled out the possibility of free will, of human beings making real moral choices that make them morally accountable. So he's in Europe, a Jewish person confronting Hitler, 6 million people are being killed. is Hitler determined by his chemistry and culture, or is he making morally responsible choices? So the concept of the image of God allows for the notion of sin. Then man is making morally responsible choices, therefore man is a sinner, animal is not. Because animal is not making morally responsible choices. The doctrine of sin then becomes a doctrine of hope. That because this is a moral choice that I have made to hate rather than to forgive, I can repent. I can ask for forgiveness. I can find forgiveness. I can be renewed. I can be transformed. Because I have to become like God. If I'm made in His image, that image has been ruined. I behave like a monkey while I should be behaving like God. So forgiveness and regeneration and transformation into the image of God, this was what was driving the Western civilization, the quest for purity, holiness, godliness. But that is all gone and is going because now you cannot say that I'm made in God's image, therefore I should be more like God. I'm in monkey's image or ape's image, therefore it's fine for me to be doing monkey business. That's where culture is going. A little while ago, a tabloid in England printed a provocative photo of a model and quoted her as saying that she hates the idea of monogamy. Why? Let's face it, we are animals. That was her reason that because the fact is that we are animals, therefore we have every right to indulge in monkey business. What's the implication of that? Just a few weeks ago, we were sitting with a younger gentleman in his mid-40s who was brilliant, intelligent, articulate, very handsome, but considering taking his life. He didn't know how many of his babies had been aborted, but he did have 3 children with 3 different women, and most of his money was going into child support and legal battles with these women. And he was saying that I now hate American women. He's been living as a monkey. Why was he living like that? Because he accepted the Freudian idea that love is nothing more than lust. Instinct is the sun setting on the west. You only have to think of those young children growing up without a father, with parents constantly in conflict, with hatred. Now, obviously, animals have some beautiful capacities that we can emulate and should emulate. And the Bible asks us to follow the ants in some of the good virtues that they have. But man is more than animals in a unique way, that he is a spiritual being, which means that he has a free will, which means that he can choose to become a sinner, but he can also, by God's grace, become like God, different than animals. That's the worldview choice. Turning man into the image of monkeys created this culture where the gentleman I described is freely indulging in monkey business and destroying the future of America and American kids. Not simply has moral and sociological and futuristic consequences, but the intellectually Darwinian, Freudian position is untenable. Let me give this simple illustration to conclude. You hear me 4 times. Supposing one of you stands up during the Q&A time and begins to imitate my mannerism and how I speak, you know, including all my grammatical mistakes and pronunciation mistakes. Now, if I believe that you are insulting me, I can get angry. Right? I can say that the McLaren Institute is a terrible institute. They invite me and then they insult me. I'm never going to come again. Now, if I believe that you are entertaining me and you are entertaining us, I can laugh and I can clap. Correct? My response, my emotion, whether I'm angry or I'm enjoying, my emotion isn't simply chemistry. It also depends on my belief. What I believe is your motive. But it's not simply what I believe to be your motive. I might believe that you're insulting me. Everyone in this room might believe that you're actually insulting me and mimicking me. You might admit that yes, your motive in mimicking me is in fact to insult me. But is it possible for me to choose to ignore the insult and look at your skill that you hear me for 4 times or 2 times or once and you can mimic me perfectly better than I do it myself? And for me to say, boy, what are you doing in Minnesota? You should be in California, in Hollywood. I'll take you there and I'll become the president of your fan club when you become an actor. You're so good. So I want to be your friend because you have a great future in Hollywood. Now, is it possible for me to ignore the insult? In other words, my emotion need not come even from my belief. It can come from values that I have chosen. My insult, my honor doesn't matter. You are precious. You are important. You are valuable. Now, that's what actually Jesus did. As he is being tortured, beaten, mocked upon, spat upon, insulted, hammered, nailed to the cross. What should his reptilian DNA demand? That he should curse, he should abuse. If he can't curse, at least ask the Father to curse them, kill them, and do whatever. But what does he do? He forgives. He loves. He's taking the sin, he's taking the death upon himself so that we might have forgiveness, we might have life. That's what Paul says is fruit of the Spirit. William James and Darwin and Freud don't explain emotions. Yes, we do have an instinctive reaction. But we are also spiritual beings. Love can ultimately become and has to become the fruit of the Spirit, a moral choice. A woman can say, I can't love this man, I hate this man, I want to divorce him, if not kill him. But by God's grace, I'm going to forgive. I'm going to love. I'm going to serve. And man can say that for his wife. That was the spirituality that sustained marriages and families, which we will pursue next week. Just what we know of ourselves, we know that Darwin's and James's and Freud's interpretation of what an emotion is not true. Because emotions aren't based simply on our chemistry or our DNA or our genetic makeup. They are based also on what we believe, our worldview, and upon our values. And it was these values captured in this painting by Michelangelo that created the Western civilization. That was the soul of Western civilization. What's happening now is that soul, the biblical worldview, is being amputated, and that is why the sun is setting. Thank you.
You have just heard that human beings are more than animals. We are spiritual beings made in God's image. Physical, intellectual, moral, or social darkness may be real, but we are not bound by nature, culture, or fate. Like God, We can transcend nature and history. We can create light. We can become a light of the world. You're invited to listen to the rest of Dr. Mangalwadi's series. It will help you understand the powerful ideas that created the modern world. It will enable you to develop your own worldview